They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, I'm thrilled because in the studio with me, I have two very rare types of people. They're both attorneys, and no, attorneys are not rare, but these two attorneys have their practices focus on representing homeowners, not associations, but homeowners. In the studio with me, I have John Cowherd. Thank you so much for joining me, John. He has just started his own practice, and he's going to tell us a little bit about it. And then in Texas, we have Bill Davis, and Bill has been on the show many a time, and he's doing a dynamite job. Thank you, Bill, for joining us.
Thank you, Shu.
All right. We're going to start with a piece of trivia that I heard in the car, and it got me to thinking. So what is the only U.S. city, capital city in the U.S. that does not have a McDonald's? And you know the answer because I told you. It's Montpelier, Vermont. But the question here is, do they have HOAs? And your guess is?
Yes.
Yes, yes. John, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about your new practice. It's a week old.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Shu. I've been practicing law, real estate litigation law here in Northern Virginia for the past 9 years. And for the past 9 days, I have been out on my own as a solo practitioner. And my practice is based here in Fairfax County in the heart of Northern Virginia. And it's been very exciting to take this opportunity at this point in my career. The inspiration for this venture is to build up a practice around, as you mentioned, representing real property owners, whether it's a residential property or perhaps you might have a family-owned condominium unit where the family-owned business operates. And I want to use my experience in community association matters and litigation, real estate, and corporate law to advocate for homeowners in their disputes with their associations, and I do not represent HOAs, and I never will. I also do litigate construction defect and warranty claims, representing both owners and from time to time some family-owned construction companies. So I'm very excited to be doing this. Over the past few years, my interest, involvement in community association disputes has increased, and starting out and setting up my own shingle is really the culmination and the start of something great that I'm looking forward to.
And you did that a while back, Bill, right?
Yes. You know, all you hear about is community and these community associations, and of course that's a facade. As long as there's going to be these HOAs, you're going to have litigation, because that is the business that HOAs are in, is litigating against their own members. So as long as they're going to be there, you're going to have litigation between HOAs and their members.
Well, CAI, when in California, when they celebrated their 25th anniversary, they wrote this big thing, article in their local magazine, and they said that the attorneys were divorce attorneys, basically. And then when the economy fell out and they just didn't have a whole lot of business, they decided to write themselves, quote unquote, a recession-proof career. So they started, you're laughing, they started writing themselves, writing the laws on how to manage associations. And now we see what we've got here. I mean, 20 years later, we see the mess we've got. And you've both been dealing with a lot of that. You both have some ideas on legislation, what's going on, how it's affecting real people, and what it's doing to the all-important property value. So I'm going to let you guys take it.
You go first, John.
Well, Shu, thank you, Bill. It's one of the topics that is hot right now in community associations law is the issue of condominium terminations. In Florida, the Florida legislature recently passed House Bill 643, and this bill is on the desk of the governor of Florida, and he's expected to sign it. I mean, he hasn't signed it yet, but that's it passed with an overwhelming majority. And the purpose of this bill is to respond to a lot of disputes and real, I mean, in my mind, human tragedies over the termination of condominiums. And you may wonder, what is a condominium termination and how is it different from, let's say, a foreclosure or just selling your unit? Well, each state is different, each set of bylaws are different, but if you have, let's say, just to pick a number, 80% votes that are willing to vote to terminate the condominium, then that majority can, there's a whole lot that they can do. They can essentially sell the property out from under the remaining 10 or 20% unit owners to a buyer. And there's really, unfortunately, short of litigation and legal action, there's really not a whole lot that the minority owners can do to combat this process. And there was down in Florida, there was a big dispute. There was a particular place, I believe it was called Madison Oaks. Shu, I think you had some of those folks here online.
I did.
And they, and this bill is a response to both those terminations and the kind of human response of, why are these people taking away my land and why isn't there anything I can do about it? And so you may wonder, how is it that a condominium is being terminated? What kind of circumstances arise where people are just saying, well, we're going to pull the plug on the whole thing? I think when most of the state legislators enact these statutes, they imagine that there would be a situation where you've got a building where everything's falling apart, the roof's caving in, the walls are falling off, and the neighborhood's going downhill, owners are running away, and really the best thing to do is just cut losses, terminate, sell the property, and do what you can in everyone's best interests. But that's not really what's happening in Florida and elsewhere. What you're finding is that there is some kind of investor who's purchased this supermajority amount. Usually it's around 80% of the membership interests. And once they get that supermajority, a lot of things happen for their benefit that are very useful. For example, they can elect a majority on the board of directors because they have 80% of the voting rights. They can hire the contractors that they want. They can hire the law firm of their choosing. They can hire the property manager. They can even hire the appraisers. Now, you don't often think about this, but you've got a bulk owner owns 80% of the units, and in a termination, you have to have all the units appraised to determine their values of what they're going to receive out of the proceeds. So if the bulk buyer owns 80% and they elect the board, and usually it's the board that's the termination trustee, the board chooses the appraisers who appraise all the units. So you can kind of see how there's how the appraisers may be
influenced.
Exactly. Influenced a bit.
Bought out.
and usually in these terminations, the buyer is some kind of affiliate of the 80% bulk owner. So you've got a unique situation where the buyer, the seller, the trustee, and everyone's kind of on the same page except for that 5, 10, 15, 20% minority interest, and they're left looking, you know, what's happening? We don't understand what's going on. So
their property values, right, have been decimated because they're only getting a small portion of what they actually paid.
Yeah, the other people probably bought earlier, and the bulk buyer's coming in and getting at a discount because the market's bad, and the other people don't get the opportunity to ride out the market. Is that what you're kind of saying, John?
No. John was right. We had I had some people from Florida Madison Oaks who came on and talked about this, but they had paid X number of dollars for their units, and they were being offered about half of what they paid for.
Oh, yeah.
And because now all of a sudden it's not worth what they paid for. And the reason it's not is what John was talking about, was the fact that you have, it's grand theft condo, isn't it?
Right. That's a good way of putting it, or a statutory roadmap to theft. It's
legalized stealing.
Well, I mean, it's a great deal if you're a bulk buyer. I mean, the reality is that these, in many cases, the buildings, the projects that are being eyed by these bulk buyers are not the rundown places where everything's broken down, the roof's caving in, and the sidewalks need to be repaved. It's the new places. It's the places that were built perhaps 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, have just left that declarant control period, and they're new, and they're in a great place to rent. And the bulk owners, and the purported buyer, you know, they know that if they terminate, it's much easier to rent out those units. They don't have to worry about setting aside reserves and handling all the ordinary governance issues, and they don't have to have a. It's just a. You know, by kicking these people out, it's improves their bottom line.
You had a situation in Texas not too long ago, Bill, where actually I think I had Mitch Katine on to talk about it, and this was waterfront property condominiums.
Yeah, I actually was going to bring that case up. Because
Great Lanes, right?
They do it a little different here, John. The what happens is there's usually combined with an insurance scam, and the management companies, involved. I haven't seen it systemic quite the way, you know, it's now statutory theft in Florida, but here there's been a number of cases where. There's insurance involved, the board members, you know, like there's some kind of harm. The board members disappear with the insurance, which, by the way, comes through the management company, which their contracts require that the management company get 10% of payouts on the insurance policy. And you have to wonder, what's that
for? Whoa.
Like? Yeah. And I know the one that you're talking about, Shu, that's the Landings Condominium in El Lago, which is really down near an area known as Clear Lake in Houston. And what's really interesting about that case was there was a big insurance payout. Board members got the insurance. They were supposed to rebuild the condominiums because you can reach a point where, well, do you rebuild or do you terminate the condominium? And
there was a fire there, right, Bill?
Pardon me?
There was a fire involved.
Oh, we're getting to that.
Okay.
Just so listeners know, you know, condominiums, and this is never told to buyers, it's a statutory-only form of ownership. So everything that deals with it is statutory, and that's another reason why you have a lot of these problems. You think you're buying something. Well, your traditional notions of ownership really don't apply at all in the condominium world because it's all governed by statute, which you may or may not be familiar with, and this is true in every state. And at any rate, termination, since it only exists in a statutory form, there's a process for terminating it. Well, the board members absconded with the insurance, and there was going to be a hearing, and literally as to whether the condominium was to be rebuilt or terminated. And literally, the night before, I don't know if literally is the correct adjective there or adverb there, but the night before the hearing, there was the arson to burn it down to make sure that it was going to be more costly to rebuild than to terminate. And this happened to be on, yes, the condominiums were older, but they were on prime real estate because the area had a no more development around the lake deal, and that condominium was old enough. It had a very large marina associated with it. It was waterfront, and it was prime development opportunity. And so that happened there. A similar process happened at, I think it was called Memorial West Condominiums. You may remember Rodney Gray did that story was in his HOA hoax video. Where, you know, where's all the money going that was supposed to go into maintenance and everything else? And the management company was responsible for that. Where did this money go? Well, the management company disappears, the records disappear, and all of a sudden people are still obligated to make payments because the condo, it's not a layaway plan. It's a, you, for the people that finance them, you take out a loan that you're obligated on, and the condo is security for repayment of it. When the condo goes away, you're not relieved of your obligation of the loan. That was just security in case you didn't pay. So you lose your condo, and you're still obligated on the loan. And the industry people just keep telling you, oh, you know, these rules are necessary to preserve property values. And I'm so sick of hearing that. I like, preserve it for who? They never tell you who it's being preserved for, but it sure as heck is not the homeowner that purchased it. Here you have... I think it's a very similar thing, but it's done a little differently. And both of those properties were, of course, snapped up by people that had been monitoring or even involved in the series of events that led to the termination of the thing. But it's not a statutory process. It's kind of brute force, burn it down.
bully tactics.
Yes.
What? You have, neither one of you has said anything at all that makes me want to run out and buy a condo.
I don't think people should be. Mama, tell your kids not to buy a condo. That's got to be the absolute worst. It is the most industry, it's worse than HOAs. anyway, go ahead, John. Tell us more about the termination of condominiums and how people are getting hosed in Florida.
I'm not licensed in Florida. I'm not here today to explain the intricacies of Florida law, but I did take a look at this new Florida reform, and I don't really know if reform is the right. I guess it is being changed from one form to another, but I don't really know if it's a. I don't know if it would be considered to be a fix or not. I mean, I guess it's. It is. It could be considered a fix, depending on how you define the word fix, but. I mean, it's one thing that strikes me about both Florida termination, condominium termination statute, and the Virginia termination statute is a really basic question. If you've got someone who, in theory, is an owner of real estate, who owns fee simple of a piece of property to call their own, they pay a mortgage, they pay local property taxes, they have to maintain it, they have to bring in contractors to improve it themselves, what percentage should be required in order to make that termination valid? Is it acceptable if one person has their property rights taken away this way? 2, 3, 4? Is 80%? Is that really acceptable? Does that mean, let's say, just hypothetically, you've got 100 units in a building, and you've got 20 unit owners who are going to be going to lose all of their equity in their main investment and lose their home where they've been living, is that something that we're comfortable with happening in a non-judicial forum where there's no jury, there's no judge, there's no one except for
no adult supervision
right.
anywhere.
Well, I mean, there's adult supervision, but they're all they're all on the, in the same camp, and
they're not adults.
Well,
they're perpetrators.
Well, that's
stealing your equity is their goal. I mean, they don't have your interest in mind. Their whole objective is to profit by literally taking whatever equity you may have, and getting it.
It's my opinion that if you want to do one of these condominium terminations, that the minority owners should have the same legal protections that a property owner has if, let's say, Fairfax County or VDOT or any governmental entity wants to come and take your land and give you what they think is fair market value. You should have the right, like in here in Virginia, that you have the right to take that case and put the issue of fair market value before a jury of landowners. So everyone, every single person sitting in the jury box has, you know, is an owner of real estate in some form or another. And I think that if we were in a situation, if we had protections like that, where there was an equal level of protection depending on how property rights were taken away, then maybe we wouldn't be having this kind of abuse.
It is abuse. It absolutely is abuse. And I think what you're saying, John, is that everybody should have a say, and it shouldn't be left up to just 80% to take away your property and your rights and your equity. Is that what you're saying?
Right, because if you look at the Florida statute, it puts some pretty hefty requirements on a homeowner if they want to come in and contest what's happening. It puts a bunch of restrictions, and it puts them in a situation where they have to fight an uphill battle to simply prove basic things like whether there was a conflict of interest involved in the transaction, or that the appraisals that were used use comparable sales that were, you know, foreclosures or tax sales or something that don't really belong in a competent appraisal for these kinds of activities. And for example, I looked at the contest section of the statute, and what it does is it requires an owner to file a petition before an arbitrator within 90 days of when the termination became effective. And I know that if someone had sent me a piece of paper and said, you're losing your house, you're going to have to move elsewhere, or you're welcome to rent from us, or that I would have a hard time trying to figure out how I'm going to move. I'm certainly not going to want to allow them to add insult to injury and pay them rent from my own unit that they've taken from me. And I also have to go and find an attorney or a legal strategy for deciphering this 15-page small print condominium termination statute to figure out what real estate rights I have left over that I can exercise. For example, under this Florida statute, it specifically limits the types of issues that an owner can contest when they want to go and file a lawsuit or bring an arbitration. They're only allowed to contest the apportionment of the proceeds, whether a lien was satisfied properly, like for a mortgage or a judgment, and whether the requisite amount of votes were made. So
it's making sure that all the I's were dotted and the T's crossed.
Right. That's a bunch of formalities that, yes, are important, but you would expect that if private property rights is the engine by which our democracy works, it's, you know, how can you have your rights that you're entitled to under the Bill of Rights, or the right to vote or to engage in the democratic process, if you don't have your home, your castle, as a place where you can exercise your First Amendment rights, for example, then what's left? I mean, if those rights can be infringed in all sorts of creative ways that folks come up with.
Good question. What's left, Bill?
Well,
that's a tough one.
It's definitely a steady erosion. I mean, I would want to try to attack these types of things on the financing so that you stop having it's an economic battle for them to take money from you, and they're always going to win out against the senior citizens who bought theirs outright with hard-earned cash. They spent their whole lives earning, but I would like to see more economic force used to eliminate these places and to deprive them of such powers. And I think one thing that might help, for example, in the case that John's talking about, is what if the law is that if there's a termination, it automatically wipes out the lien, okay? And then so to the extent that the proceeds get paid out, they have to go. They go to pay off the mortgage lender or whoever it was, but it wipes out the lien. You can't have a deficiency. All righty. Now how many lenders are going to want to be lending?
I was going to say, now what happens with the lending institution? But that's a good point. I like that idea.
It's the homeowner that's getting hosed in this whole thing. But you know, the homeowner wouldn't be in that position, but for lenders that are also more than happy to lenders who aren't really lenders. They lend, but they sell it, so they get reimbursed, and then they become servicers. And so their business now is not in the validity of the loan or how good it is or anything else. They were always trying to sell it to somebody like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or a government-sponsored entity or one of these securitized trust, you know, type of thing. But if you look at the industry's concerns, they're very concerned about maintaining federal financing for HOA property and condo property. And they got very concerned, you know, when the FHFA came in and became a conservator over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and said, no, we don't like these transfer fees, and no, if there's more than 10% of the condos, you know, in arrears on assessments, which, by the way, many of those assessments were manufactured by the management companies because of the entanglement and how they would create these junk fees, and then they would divert assessment monies to themselves, allegedly for payment of junk fees that the homeowner never agreed to. Things of that nature. But, you know, that started putting a pinch on things and tightened the financing for them. But I think if you can, it's a second best world, unfortunately, and if they're going to build these things, then maybe can structure into it that, well, that's all fine and good, but anybody who buys one of these loans, your recourse in the event it's terminated is whatever the proceeds, you know, the homeowner would have got. You can't go out to the homeowner for a deficiency.
Well, I think that the new Florida statute does provide additional protections for lien holders, but it's not much of a consolation if you're a homeowner and let's say you were very responsible and you took out a 20% down payment and you even you're paying down your loan faster than other people because you don't want to pay interest, and then you've got a neighbor who has they're more or less underwater on their property,
yeah,
and they've got a whole bunch of different credit line deeds of trust and first mortgages, second mortgages, and so on. And then in termination, the book buyer comes in and looks to see who has these liens and figures out, oh well, we don't want to litigate against this big national bank over this lien and what they're entitled to. Because you know they have large law firms on retainer, we'll just pay them off. And this guy over here, who as you say, was like a senior citizen who bought the entire unit with cash, they don't get the advantage of that sweetheart deal that the lien holder did. So I think some of this lien holder appeasement aspect of the whole thing is, I mean, it helps people who are underwater, through no fault of their own, but it doesn't.
It's definitely not a fix, but I don't think the lien holder ought to be getting any preference at all. Here, I've always thought it was absurd that, oh, okay, we're going to have this facade that in order, because no one would ever lend money to buy in one of these places otherwise, unless the lender's lien is superior to the HOA's lien, which kind of begs the question, well, how is that? Then how can you foreclose on the homeowner? There's some crazy. There's some homestead law here that's not the same in other states, but you know they come up with a legal fiction, and in order to try and rationalize some type of behavior, and then to prop it up, all the things they have to do to keep propping up the fiction just make it look even more absurd and more absurd as to how they can rationalize any of this stuff. But I wouldn't think that they could give a lien holder any more, because the lien holders only have a security interest, and so it seems to me that they need to be allocating the money across the property owners, although the lien holder would get it before the property owner does, but the lien holder might not have a remedy afterwards. There's still going to be people hurt, people who own them outright and everything else, but what I'm trying to do is attack this form of ownership. It shouldn't even be tolerated. It's calling it free. I'm not an anti-free world type of thing, but to call this free is a joke, because you're not free to negotiate anything. The law has been written against you. It's not free in that sense of the word. All the rules and everything are put into place by people who never had your interest at heart to begin with. So, you know, I'd like to see the investment in these things, you know, eliminate federal funding for a bunch of this type of stuff. And I think it's going to have to go away, or they'll have to find alternative sources, and things would have to change.
Well, I think that for our listeners, it's important to talk about, well, if you've got a listener out there who owns a condominium and they live in there, they like the neighborhood, they like their particular unit, they're happy with their mortgage, then, you know, they, for them, a lot of this stuff that we're talking about is a little academic, because we can talk about whether condominiums ought to exist or whether there should be a large scale reform of condominium law to make it closer to traditional property.
It hasn't happened to them, and they're not aware.
That's a big. That's a big thing. Yeah.
How fragile their quote ownership
right.
is.
Well, usually they don't. Unfortunately, a lot of those owners don't realize that until the.
That's what we do on the show.
Right. They've called the property manager five times, and they haven't gotten an answer except for some one page legal form that doesn't make any sense, and then they find Shoe's show online. And by that time, a lot of water has already gone under the bridge. But I think that there are a lot of things that condo owners or owners of townhouses or other common interest communities can do to protect themselves on the legal side that other than they just give up or go. We all know that if you try to go and legislate, try to go and lobby, you're really lobbying for the future. You can't really lobby for a particular dispute that you're struggling with or may struggle with currently. Bill, can you describe I'm not asking you to give away all your secrets in case you've got opposing counsel listening to this radio show, but if you could give our listeners some ideas of ways that attorneys can, you know, use their, you know, what they can do and what they know to make a difference in these types of disputes where just going it alone is not going to achieve the same kind of result.
Is it a dispute, or is this, I mean, we talked about theft a while ago.
Well, theft's a dispute, isn't it?
It's a crime. It's a crime. I mean, a dispute is, I don't know. To me, a dispute is several rungs lower on the list. There's a legal thing. Go on, Bill.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to answer your question, because the cases I've dealt with are basically predators that targeted people.
Yeah.
And I sincerely believe that it isn't just a civil matter. There's a psychological thing going on, and many of these people have serious issues, and that's what attracts them to these HOAs, because it's designed to facilitate them. The management companies groom them. They love these kind of folks, and you know, the predator's not going to negotiate in good faith. They're not going to it's really not a civil matter between equals. It is a group that believes that they are superior and is on the attack, that enjoys. I don't know if you've ever watched Dr. Solomon's videos. I don't agree with all of them, but I think that they're very well worth watching. His HOAacademy.com, I think it is, are very well worth watching, because I don't have a background in psychology. My background is engineering and science and things like that, but But I wondered, why hasn't there been more of a study on this? And I often thought, you know, this reminds me of the discussion of Stanley Milgram and the work he did back in the late 60s, I think it is, the perils of obedience and stuff like that. People, that these boards have to keep telling them, you must do this, you must do this. It always operates through fear, threats, and an appearance of authority. And people need to reject that, step out of that box, do not listen to these management companies, do not, you know, believe everything they tell you. And just because it's written on paper does not make it so. But these types of folks, you know, don't, they're not going to stop just because you ask them a question or demand records or something like that. They'll use all the HOA funds trying to refuse to provide the records. They've got an insurance policy that your assessments went to go pay for them. Part of your assessments in many places of the country, which I do think this is another law that needs to be implemented everywhere to prohibit this, your assessments get used and donated. Remember, this is money they took from you under threat of foreclosure, get donated to the lobbying groups for these management companies who go out and seek to get even more aggressive laws against you. You know, it's pretty horrendous. I don't know how to answer your question unless it's about a specific issue. But, I mean, unfortunately, when they come and sue one of my clients, I usually end up do some background research. I typically find that most of the claims of the HOA are completely unsupported. And I've been working on developing alternative causes of action so that the homeowner can recover from the HOAs. You know, many of the laws are written very one way so that if the HOA prevails, it gets attorney's fees and things like that, but the homeowner never does. And so I've been working to develop other theories of recovery for the homeowner and not the standard, you know, kind of response, because it's kind of a specialized practice area. And I think a lot of times an attorney who isn't familiar with the laws that are been very specific to HOAs is going to get themselves in trouble if they're just relying upon standard contract law or things of this nature, because, you know, those rules, for whatever reason, don't apply in the HOA world. But I don't know that I answered your question, but basically we go back after them, and you know, in some cases we seek to terminate the HOA, and I'm not talking about condos, I'm talking about HOAs. I've got a case right now where none of the paperwork shows that the HOA was never had any authority over four of the six sections of the subdivision. There was only one section that was supposed to have one, or two sections. And yet they've been collecting assessments for years and foreclosing on people and threatening people. And it's like, you know what, this is a great case. This is a fraud. This is a fraudulent lien case. And these people, and the management company in particular, need to be punished for this. And, you know, I don't think people should take this stuff sitting down. But I know I don't think I've really answered your question, but I'm not quite sure. Maybe you can rephrase it or something.
I think I've got a juicier question for you. Okay. Might be more interesting. I know that frequently, like when I get calls about from owners or from dissident minority directors, usually, you know, they come to me, but sometimes they'll mention that they have someone that's a friend of theirs, that's an ally within their association. It might just be one person, it might be many, and I know that the industry and its trade groups and the other side of the equation on this has done a great job of using strength in numbers to achieve what they're trying to achieve, which is their salaries and investments and so on. Have you discovered any strategies for effectively handling joint representations of multiple unit owners or homeowners within a community association, or is there a number of different options? I think this might be of interest to not only to me, but also to the listeners who may be thinking, well, what could we do together that we can't do on our own?
Well, I can tell you one thing. We'll find out if it's successful. How about that? You know, the people that get brought into it by the HOA, they're in it. They don't really have a choice. And so I'm defending some of those. But what we're doing is there's other homeowners very angry and frustrated about what's going on. But rather than joining them into this case and making it more, because they don't necessarily have the same claims, Texas has a pre-suit petition process that's discovery only. The discovery is one way. Okay, so let's suppose all these homeowners, especially based upon what we've learned in the HOAs like to control the information too. It's very important for the homeowners that find themselves in this stuff to get a web page up, or, you know, I'm not a real big fan of Facebook, but if they want to use Facebook, fine. I'll get a web page up, a Yahoo page, something like that, so they can disclose what's going on and do it accurately, get copies of court petitions or whatever for other people to read, because the HOA board, or if they're in some cases they're pretending to be an HOA board, will want to control the information. And management companies do the same thing. They will disseminate only what they want to, and they will usually misrepresent what's going on because they've got to maintain control and obedience from all the other homeowners, you know, and fear. I mean, because that's how these things work. And what we're trying in a case is having, you know, the homeowners that originally get sued, there's nothing they can do except defend and assert claims against the board. They're already in it, right? There's nothing they can do. But the other homeowners who are angry about what's going on, they can file what's called in Texas, a Rule 202 pre-suit petition. And it's a discovery action only. And it's one way. So it means that those homeowners can now get discovery from the HOA in anticipation of filing a suit against the HOA or its board members, okay? And now you've got, you know, the one reason the management companies, the HOA attorneys do what they do is it's kind of an in terrorem type effect on the homeowners. They want to terrorize them. They want to scare them. You know, pay us money and we'll go away. Otherwise, we're going to control the HOA to sue you. Well, this is going to have a similar effect because you give us the information we're seeking or the board members are about to get sued. And there's sure they can have insurance defense, but what can the insurance defense do? There's not any claims asserted. It's a discovery only action, and you know the HOA tends to operate by having a whole bunch of power and economics that they direct, you know, like a laser on one person or a very small set of people. But I don't think they're very well equipped to handle hits from more than one side. At all, they're really designed to, you know, it's just oppressive, massive force against a very small group of people. But if you have more than one group of persons, maybe that's the answer to your question: is not necessarily joining forces in a single lawsuit, but having multiple actions going, especially to deal with recalcitrant and incorrigible boards and things like that. That's one of the things that we're doing in discovery. And then we're going after, it's hard to go after board members, but I think there's cases where when the board members have been stealing money, or actually, you know, I've got a case right now where these four guys just decided to tell everybody they were the HOA and have been collecting money from people. They lied. They've been collecting money from people for 15 years, doing what they want with it, no financial reports. They interfere with title closings because they will, you know, provide information to the title company and say, hey, you have to pay us X dollars. So they interfere with every single title closing. To me, that's also insurance fraud because the title company is trying to issue an insurance policy based on the representation to these people, which is false.
Oh, that's, you know, a good point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it never stops. And so I think hitting from more than one side. And it is very helpful for both psychologically, sometimes financially, and strategically to have support from other homeowners, even if they're not going to be directly involved in your lawsuit.
I think one of the issues that we keep running into is that the other homeowners are afraid of getting involved. They're afraid of speaking out because they're terrified that they're going to be targeted next.
Well, shoot, I've got an answer to that. Let me seize upon that. That's one reason for them not to join your lawsuit because they don't want to be a target. But see, this discovery action I was telling you about, Well, you can form an organization. Let's call it Concerned Citizens of Happy, give me a name of an HOA.
Happy Homeowners from Hell.
Okay. This
yeah.
is the
HHH.
Right. Okay. So the HHH, these are, it's comprised of people who are members of the organization who own property in the subdivision. Okay. So what you do is you file, they form an unincorporated association, an unincorporated entity. Okay. That entity has standing to file suit. Okay, it's seeking discovery. Okay, so it has standing to file suit. Well, now, and the discovery is only one way. All righty, it's discovery against the HOA. So they can get their information. They don't have to reveal exactly who the members of the group are. Okay, their name doesn't appear directly on a petition because it's at least here it's called in. The style of the case would be in re, and then the name of the organization.
Have you had any trouble with standing arguments that you're not showing at least one person who can, you know, pull out their deed to show that they have standing to request these documents? I know this is kind of a technical question, but
it hasn't been a problem yet. But worst case, you can always have the people who are being sued also be a member of that group. Okay. And so you've got at least one person. I mean, the HOA is claiming that they're, you know, it can't very well challenge that issue. But it doesn't have to be limited to, you know, in Texas and many other states, it's an entity theory state. So the organization is an entity separate and apart from its members. And so as long as you can show at least one member would have standing to do this in their own name, then the organization's going to have standing to do it. And that's easy enough if the people who are already involved in a lawsuit are also members of the organization.
You see, Shu, homeowners can use corporate law to...
Just as easily, huh?
Absolutely.
Fight fire with fire.
Is that...
Exactly.
Is that a statutory requirement, or is that something that anybody in any state can do, whether they have a McDonald's or not?
Well, it's going to be case law probably in any state. Whether you're recognized as a separate entity or not, there's a thing called... Without getting too far off topic, there's what's called aggregate theory of entities, and there's also entity theory. And aggregate theory says an entity is merely a collection of its members, and therefore we're going to disregard the entity. You see that a lot in federal law, which is all screwed up. You see that a lot in federal law and in tax law. For example, tax law, partnerships are disregarded as an entity, and the partnership is the tax is of the individual partners. Okay, so a partnership is an unincorporated entity is not treated separate and apart from its members under federal law, typically, okay? But a corporation is because it's incorporated. It's separate from its shareholders. Well, under state law, at least in this state, and I think most other states, it's an entity theory state. So, for example, a partnership is separate and apart from its members. That's why in Texas, even though we don't have a personal state income tax, they have what's called a franchise tax that businesses have to pay. So the partnership, even though it's passed through for federal purposes, is not passed through in Texas because it is an entity and it can be taxed even though its individual partners cannot be taxed. Anyway, I've got way off topic on that. But
for our listeners, should they conceptualize this as a political party within their HOA or a political action committee or some kind of something like the Sierra Club, just to give them a flavor for what
it's something like. It's a tactic that environmental groups use, although I disagree with most of those tactics, but in fact it's very active here right now in groundwater fights. But basically, people in an area that have a common problem, they form an organization. It doesn't have to be nonprofit. It doesn't have to be an incorporated entity. They just form a coalition or an alliance, okay, an unincorporated association, if you want to call it that. And by the way, about 30 years ago, most HOAs were unincorporated. You know, the corporatization came about a little later. But they form that organization. That is viewed as an entity with standing because its members have standing. And it can sue. What it can get may differ from state to state. Like some states may say, well, that organization can only get an injunction as opposed to damages, but I'm pretty confident that the organization will be able to, like in Texas, pre-suit petition, you're seeking only discovery. So you're not seeking a remedy per se. What you're doing is getting discovery in anticipation of filing another lawsuit.
And this it's just a result that can be achieved through this kind of teamwork and association
yes.
amongst the yes. the owners that can't it would be very cumbersome and
yes.
and if you're just a bunch of individuals trying to converge on the same goal independently. That's great. That's good stuff.
Yes, and the discovery is one way. So the homeowners get to ask, but the HOA doesn't get to ask them.
So how does that work? That's interesting.
Well, they have a complaint. You know, they're investigating a complaint. Like, why aren't they turning over any records? Where's the financials? How come they're not following their own bylaws? We want to do further investigation. We believe now, based upon other information, there's a fraud going on here. Okay, they don't get damages from the pre-suit petition process. All they can get is discovery because they're essentially investigating whether to file. It's kind of funny because you bring it as a lawsuit, but it's a very specialized lawsuit. You're bringing it solely to seek discovery to determine whether to file a lawsuit and who it should be filed against.
We have something okay. similar to that here in Virginia, and it's used both with these non-stock corporations like what you have with HOAs or Sierra Club. It's also used in the for-profit corporate context where if you're a shareholder or a director and you make a demand for documents by sending a letter and then that's ignored or rebuffed, then you can seek a judicial review of the fact that you're entitled to these documents and they haven't been provided. But it's and as you say, it's an independent suit that
yeah.
where the fact that you may not have a cause of action yet that would entitle you to damages or some of the remedy you're really looking for, there it's a way to get into court and to get what you're entitled to without having to know everything when you're in this lopsided situation where one side has access to the information and the other side doesn't, and then they use that, they leak out the information depending on what's how it suits them. You know, there's from Texas, I know you must like country music, and there's a song by Miranda Lambert called White Liar, and one of the lyrics in that song is the truth comes out a little at a time, and I won't sing it for you because
we're almost out of time.
But sometimes whether it's in HOA business or in litigation, that's the tactic that you're up against. But with strategies like what you've described, there's options that are available to homeowners that perhaps aren't included in
Let me just add a couple more ideas behind this. There's a question about what's covered about it in insurance. There's no claim asserted. You're investigating a claim. So now they got a problem with insurance coverage, which they've always relied upon to create a big disadvantage between the homeowner and the organization. Okay? So insurance is going to be like, well, there's no claim asserted. What coverage do you have? We're not, you know, none. There hasn't actually been a claim filed. They're investigating whether to file a claim. So they're going to have a problem with insurance coverage. And getting free representation, essentially. They can't file any counterclaims, okay? So it's basically a one-way discovery action. And it's going to be a lot more cost-effective because and you also can't file claims in this thing. All you can do is serve discovery and deal with discovery. That's it. And so you know you're not going to have to be dealing with counterclaims. You know that you can control the discovery process to a great extent, and they're juggling that along with and of course they're going to be scared to death that some of that information is going to leak out and get into the other case that they've got pending against the homeowner. Well, let's put it this way. The ones that I'm dealing with should be scared that the information would be leaking out and get over to the other home.
Well, Bill, I'm glad you're on our side and we don't have to
absolutely
litigate against you.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us. I know that you've both given some great information out there to our listeners who are always going to be looking for help and have a lot of questions. I hope you'll both be back together sometime.
You bet.
Will do. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing notes.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.